So, welcome to the Kelty Mental Health Resource Center's Pinwheel Education Session on Eating Disorders in Boys and Men. The Pinwheel Education Series is a monthly forum that brings together experts and persons with lived experience to talk about mental health and mental wellness. Everything related to the Pinwheel Series, including a recording of today's session, can be found on our website at www.keltymentalhealth.ca/pinwheel. We appreciate your feedback, so if you can please fill out our feedback form, which is on the table here if you're in person, or if you're over the phone or in telehealth, it's listed on our event page, so you can just fill it out there and send it to us via email. So for those of you that are joining us for the first time, the Kelty Mental Health Resource Center is a provincial mental health and substance use information and resource center serving BC children, youth, and families. We also offer peer support to families and youth, as well as to people of all ages struggling with eating disorders. You can go to our website at www.keltymentalhealth.ca for more information, resources, and for our contact information. So for those of you that are joining us via telehealth, sorry that you can't see us. So if you have problems with your telehealth during the session, you can call your local telehealth support or you can call PHSA telehealth support at 604-875-2000, extension 6492. So before I invite our speakers to take the floor, I'm going to ask everyone in the room to put their phones on mute, please. And for those of you that are on the phone listening in, if you can please mute your phones either directly, directly on your phone, or you can press *6, and that'll just help reduce background noise for us and make the listening experience more enjoyable for everyone. So our first speaker is Paul Galan. Yeah. Paul is on the phone with us today, and he brings more than 30 years of experience in healthcare and 10 years in the field of males with eating disorders. He has advised on numerous provincial, national, and international awareness initiatives, including abstracts presented in Australia, the United States, and Canada. He has contributed towards increased awareness of males with eating disorders through a variety of media, including a nationally televised documentary. Paul is a recognized leader and partnership builder in Canadian healthcare. He engages stakeholders in health as the president of Gallant Healthworks and is the chair of the Canadian College of Health Leaders in the Lower Mainland. He is also currently working as a men's group leader slash quality of life specialist with Dr. Birmingham and Associates. So very busy man. We're really happy to have him here. So take it away, Paul.
So first of all, again, thank you, Kelty Center and partners for inviting me to participate today. I'm unfortunately not able to be in the room. I'm on the road coming back from a family visitation in Banff. So I'm in Merritt right now in a parking lot having this conversation, which I'm very happy to have. And I want to welcome our other speakers also, at least one of who I know fairly well, and of course our audience. So I believe I have about 15 to 17 minutes, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So I'll speak for about 15 minutes. And so my observations I wanted to talk to you about come, first of all, as a department head in acute care at St. Paul's Providence Healthcare many years ago, and then as a recreation therapist focusing on wellness, quality of life, and working in mental health and education later as a researcher, that led me to some of my work around males with eating disorders. My work includes working directly with the males with eating disorders in terms of leading discussion groups, leading groups with other agencies, and then actually working directly with males on a what I would call a quality of life counseling basis. When I began some of my work with males, there wasn't the greatest awareness of males with eating disorders, to be a fair statement to say. The clinicians had little experience in helping males effectively through their eating disorders, through getting better or through coping. So I decided to look at some research and to work directly with males on men's issues because I found these issues were at least equally severe as women's issues or female issues, and that in some cases, quality of life for males may even be poorer than quality of life in females with eating disorders. So in some cases, in working with the provincial programs, we know that males would sometimes show up and not necessarily return for appointments after screening. And I guess this caused me some concern and some of our therapists, certainly. And we began a men's clinical resource group with some of the staff. And then later on, a men's interest group was founded in partnership with another external agency. And I actually co-led some sessions there. for about 20 sessions with men, both in the hospital jointly through this group, and then in the community. And this was also part of my PhD studies, which I call my never-ending story, as I'm still working towards those. So my area of work and quality of life has been since the middle of 1980s, and wellness has always been part of the work that I do, so I wanted to just situate the context of my conversation there, as well as better access to healthcare services. So I naturally, I would say from my work, became interested in working with males. Now, we know more than 300 years ago, Dr. Richard Morton documented the first case of a male with anorexia nervosa, the same time as he diagnosed or worked with the first cited female case. So males with eating disorders have not been a new thing necessarily, or a new population, but it's been certainly a population that is somewhat understudied, in my opinion, undertreated. So when I began about 2004, there were few to no known services in Canada specifically designed to meet the needs of men with eating disorders. And male patients sometimes often felt doubly disadvantaged. Males with eating disorders were less likely to receive care or treatment. And sometimes for those males who did receive treatment, they were likely to receive less care than females in similar programs. So I think it would be important to review part of the purpose of my area of research and study was around better understanding the healthcare issues and access experiences for males with eating disorders, and that's situated around a quality of life lens. Now, we know, or most people on the phone or on this conversation probably will know, that eating disorders involve distorted body images that make it difficult for people to nourish themselves in a healthy way. And include anorexia nervosa, with dramatic weight loss combined with an intense fear of gaining weight. And it also even includes bulimia nervosa, which is bouts of uncontrollable eating followed by purging, which may include vomiting, and binge eating disorders, or compulsive eating disorder. And, of course, the largest category of eating disorders typically is called EDNOS, E-D-N-O-S, which stands for Eating Disorders Not Otherwise Specified, which really includes a mix of symptoms that don't fall neatly into any one of the fully diagnostic categories. As we also may know, there's a combination of factors that influence or that lead to eating disorders, including psychological factors that may include low self-esteem, feelings of inadequacy, or lack of control, depression, anger, or loneliness. And we also know that interpersonal factors, such as sometimes troubled family background or personal relationships, difficulty expressing emotions and feelings, and a history sometimes of physical, sexual abuse or teasing also leads to eating disorders. And that media promotion of unrealistic images and goals, along with a tendency to equate or equal a person's value with their physical appearance, is another contributor, certainly. Also, genetics plays a link in terms of certain chromosomes, especially chromosome 1 and 10. And so what I want to preface this conversation is, just as it is a mistake to think that only females get eating disorders, we know that at least one in four people with eating disorders are males. It's also a mistake to assume that all males with eating disorders possess the same traits and experiences. So, for example, males with eating disorders are all different, are all unique. They certainly have different experiences and varied issues and very different personalities, although another common misconception is that males with eating disorders are all athletes, or they're obsessed with working out to become more muscular, or that they're all gay and vainly in pursuit of a pursuit of the perfect body. So again, these are misconceptions. So what I'd like to speak about next is just some of my particular research and some of the review of research that I've done, my own experiences I'll add in as we go through. And feel free to give me a two-minute warning as my time comes to an end, please. So we know that access to healthcare remains at the forefront of Canada's healthcare debate. We know that difficulty accessing healthcare delays treatment, increases the risk of complications related to late diagnosis, and reduces quality of life for men with eating disorders. We also know that much of society, including health providers, are largely unaware that males struggle with eating disorders or do not fully understand males with eating disorders. Yet, we know that eating disorders are potentially devastating mental illnesses affecting both men and women, and that they can cause extensive physical complications such as cardiac dysrhythmia, congestive heart failure, loss of sexual interest and potency in males, severe obesity, renal failure, liver damage, electrolyte imbalances, low blood sugar, weakened immunity, osteoporosis, and death. And death by suicide is not uncommon. We also know that some of the added psychosocial complications of eating disorders include low self-esteem, poor concentration, mood swings, fatigue, social withdrawal, and difficulty maintaining relationships. I think it would be fair to say that a person would not choose to have an eating disorder. They would not choose to have these symptoms or these complications as a result of wanting to pursue a perfect body, as is part of the misconception. So we know that healthcare access experiences and quality of life with males who have eating disorders are very limited in the literature review and in the research. We also know that males do comprise 25% of eating disorders, do not receive treatment in most cases. Males with eating disorders are less likely to receive care, and for those males who do receive care, they were likely to receive less care, as mentioned before. So not necessarily a great picture for males, I would say. In my 10 years of working with males, part of the initial research actually focused on just creating awareness among some of the healthcare professionals work with, and I was lucky enough to get some airtime on global national television through a documentary that helped raise some awareness there, and also the National Eating Disorders Information Center had me write a guest article in the bulletin focusing on body image and males, and so I would hope that this has slightly increased some interest in working with this population, but also the needs of males are sometimes unmet, or often unmet in healthcare, and even in community diagnosis, working with family physicians and awareness. So we know that in males, body dissatisfaction are related more to shape and muscularity, and appears to be a greater predictor of eating disorders symptoms than concern with weight alone, as is the case for females. We know that from research, men are believed to have later onset, be more prone to overexercising, and use vomiting less than females. And certainly my own observations and the research of others suggest that males are not always comfortable in a female-oriented treatment program. And in males and females, basically there's a denial of the existence of eating disorders as a problem by some. And this does little to encourage treatment seeking, certainly, among those who are already uncertain about the recovery. But also, I think the false belief that eating disorders are self-inflicted illnesses that have created a negative stigma for any person struggling with this illness leads to an additional stigmatization for males. And that is, males who already feel isolated in therapeutic sessions, sometimes with women, further complicates their health-seeking behavior. So studies basically consistently report that men are often reluctant to seek help and support for any medical condition, and particularly mental illness, even when the symptoms may be more marked. For example, in one study of about 135 males with eating disorders, it found that men seek help less frequently than women with eating disorders, and that men presented with higher levels of depression than their female counterparts. And my argument or my strategy is not to basically discount services, of course, for females with eating disorders. We need to look at males and females issues as, first of all, in the public Canadian health system, there is a right for health care, and there is a right for support, in my opinion. Unfortunately, some of the preambles in terms of the diagnostic DSM-4 TR that was most recent, and now it's been adopted to the new criteria, had a criteria for males for anorexia, for example, that included a menstrual cycle. So obviously men don't have menstrual cycles, or the last time I was working in healthcare, I didn't notice that any men had menstrual cycles. So when treatment is sought, there's actually some bias in terms of some of the tools that help screen males for eating disorders. And one of these tools previously included a question on menstruation, which was a mandatory question. It wasn't a question, for example, that said, you know, if you're a male, please answer this question. And I do recall some very blunt statements from some of the males I've worked with that said, you know, when I went and filled out that questionnaire and I saw the word menstruation there, I was immediately just turned away from this program, thinking there's actually there's very little awareness that, this can be an offensive question. Also, that the environment created included mostly, or actually exclusively, female-oriented literature and female-oriented posters and advertisements, so that men were feeling even less empowered or less willing to seek the treatment when they were presenting for it. So in a way, in some cases, the men are turned off from the messages they're getting from even the health-related services. So we know that when treatment is sought, establishing an effective therapist-client alliance is critical to the therapeutic process. The decision to seek professional help is a defining moment in the recovery of persons with eating disorder, and certainly the initial consultation with a health professional can be a make-or-break situation, as in the case of some of the males I've worked with, in terms of actually showing up for an initial appointment and then in reviewing their charts in terms of why they hadn't came back, the chart comment would say, the male seemed uncomfortable in this environment, or the male asked questions and we just told him to come back for the next appointment, but weren't able to answer his questions. And so in those cases, you can imagine being a male who's reaching out with all the society pressures that can, that help sometimes males not seek treatment, can be barriers. So the care provider needs to better understand what it's like to be a man with eating disorder, and that both empathy and respect are important qualities of any professional hoping to help stimulate change for both men and women with eating disorders. So obviously practices that lead to increased understanding and alliances between health providers and patients include some of those that I've used, which are based on community engagement. And community engagement practices are a little non-traditional in healthcare, I would say. So basically they help improve awareness that a population exists. So by informing the community, they help improve practices such as consulting, involving, and collaborating, and empowering the stigmatized individuals. I truly do believe many men with eating disorders, just as females are stigmatized by society and sometimes by their peers. And these practices are useful in improving involvement of individuals in both alliance building and relationship building that leads to increased empowerment and better healthcare management. I just want to end with saying that some of the males who I've seen want treatment, and there's a large a bias that suggests that males do not want treatment or are reluctant. In the cases of the males I've seen, all of them wanted treatment. All of them were told something similar to that males do not have eating disorders, there's nothing for males, or that they do not meet the female criteria for treatment. These are the words of males themselves. They felt stigmatized and dismissed without any added forms of support, and some of these males stated they were misunderstood, overlooked, and now uncertain about exactly where and how to seek support for eating disorders, despite wanting treatment and wanting to recover. So thank you. I will end there.
Great. Thank you so much, Paul. Okay, so our next speaker is here in the room with us. So Tom Boslaw has an MA from Simon Fraser University in psychology. He's been working in mental health for 20 years, specializing in eating disorders for the last 12 years. 3 years ago, Tom took on a new role as a youth and family clinical resource educator with a specific focus of working with families of youth in the eating disorders program here at PC Children's Hospital.
Hey, that's me. I don't have, I think, a lot to say, but what I was going to just talk about is some of the stuff that we do here, so... I'll talk about what I know about. So I work here in the hospital in an intensive treatment program. We have 10 beds. My job is a new job that's working with parents, giving education and support. Kids that come into our program are tertiary level kids. That means they're... their needs haven't been met in other programs, and they come to us as kind of the next step. This is an inpatient program where they stay 2 to 3 months on average, and sometimes more and sometimes less. Our goal is to get their weight back up, give them some skills, and my job is to help give parents the skills that they need to continue this treatment at home. So... In our program, We get about 10% males into the program. So we looked up over the last 10 years, there are 23 males admitted to our intensive program, and about 100 overall in all the programs that we have here, outpatients and day treatment included. Most of those are diagnosed with anorexia. And more of the males that we get in, or of the younger patients that we get in, a higher percentage of them are males. So in our kind of 10, 11, 12 age range, we have about 25% males, and that decreases as they get older. So one of the areas that I kind of specialize in is working with males and also working with young children. And so there's some kind of overlap there. The younger ones also tend to be more males. I'm in a bit of a different place than Paul, because I work with kids who have already been through the system and all have already gotten through the hurdles of getting into treatment. So I'm not as familiar with that journey to get here. I'm more familiar with the actual treatment and what do we do with them. So what do we do with them? And the way that I sum it up, and I told this to one of our parents who had a younger boy, and she thought it was accurate. So the way I look at them is that they're the same but different to the female patients. That a lot of the things seem very similar in terms of course of treatment and time they're here, and their rate of weight gain and some of the thoughts that they have, some of the avoidance, that those things are quite similar. And our program is integrated male and female, so we usually have 9 or 10 females and 1 or 2 boys at a time. So to me, the illness seems similar, but males and females are different. And it's hard to kind of say how that's different, but they seem to have kind of different ways of looking at this, a different story that they tell about their eating disorder, different strategies about how they look at it, different things that motivate them, and different ways they display these things. So we give our patients some outside time in the middle of the day. And female patients go and they walk around in circles in the back. And the male patients are more likely to play or to play soccer or sports or that kind of thing. And it's just a slight difference in how they do that and how they act with that. The people that I see, I don't see a lot of difference in how they experience the eating disorder or how they talk about it or how they look at that or how they judge themselves. I think overall there's probably a lot more bias and stigma with men with eating disorders. But with the group that I work with, I don't see that as much. Because we work with adolescents, one of the things that most of the patients worry about is, what do I say when I go back to school, and how do I tell my friends, and all that kind of thing. And I actually don't see too much of a difference between the groups, that everyone worries about that. And I think often it's actually worse for the female patients, because they probably think about it a lot more. And they worry about all the social drama and gossip and all that goes along. Male patients seem to do that a little bit less. They probably think about it the same, but they probably don't talk about it as much. When we send kids home, I think it actually often is somewhat helpful for male patients. in the social context, that the idea of going to school and sitting in the cafeteria and eating lunch in front of your friends actually probably works better for boys than for girls, because what we hear all the time is that nobody eats lunch at school and all the other girls are skipping lunch, and probably a bit better for boys. So that's kind of all my brief observations, and I'll throw whatever other time I have open for questions at the end.
Sure.
Or now.
Okay, thank you, Tom. So our next two speakers are people with lived experience. We're going to start first with our parent with lived experience. Susie is our next speaker. Susie Da Silva is a mom with a son with an eating disorder. So Susie, I'll pass it along to you.
Hi there. I a lot of things that Paul has said I can completely relate to, and I promised my son when I consented to doing this that part of this was his journey, and my talk would be about a role as a parent, my husband, my journey through this. And I think that anyone who has a child that's unwell can relate how traumatic it is. A lot of things Paul said about risk factors, there is many things that we can't relate to. We're very boring, average family, and my son was very young when he developed his eating disorder. I feel very strongly about Tom's role, and probably Paul's too, in educating parents, because home is where it's at, especially because our son was so young. I really stress the role of parents supporting parents in a healthy way, because there's many things to be learned from each other, and we're kind of the ones that's doing the work at home. And the individuality of each person's journey as to why they develop an eating disorder, either male or female, though there are certain risk factors and society pressures and stuff like that, are very different, and that totally needs to be stressed. We have worked very hard at incorporating. We have a very busy, active life and great community. These were number one things in helping us get better, not that we haven't had challenges. I'm a nurse. I am highly connected in our community, and that fortunately probably saved our son's life, because when I was suspicious of this, this did not go on for a long time. Accessing treatment and stuff like that, but it breaks my heart that it would be very difficult for most people who don't have those kinds of resources, and I feel very strongly about coordinating people and parents and awareness. On a personal note, I've worked in the emergency department for the past 20-some years, and I can't tell you how many times I think we've missed underlying causes of medical and physical issues, and so bringing awareness and compassion from, you know, a healthcare provider is huge. Very humbling on my husband's and I behalf, because we thought we had a pretty strong, average, boring family, and then we were struck by this. And I appreciate people that I think can't be here, because there's a lot of people out there running and walking for you. A lot of understanding, but not a lot of understanding for mental health issues. So that is really kind of, you know, the reason I'm here, and we are doing well, and we continue to do well, and we continue to work hard every day. We have a huge support of family and community that kind of embrace our situation and how we do it. We speak very openly in our house, so we're lucky to have that, sometimes too openly. So really, that's about all I have to say. However, I just want to stress again the importance of parents connecting with other parents and realizing that they're not alone. Their journey is very similar, yet different and individual, and there's lots to be learned from each other so that you can apply it to your own situation. And that's about it.
Thank you, Susie. Okay, so our final speaker today is here in person, and he's sitting right here. So Aidan Scott is the founder of Speakbox, a first-of-its-kind Canadian social enterprise working to bring digital technology to depression treatment alongside digital peer support services. Aiden is currently one of the five faces of mental illness as part of a national campaign put on by the Canadian Alliance on Mental Illness and Mental Health, which seeks to move the agenda forward, improving funding and care for those struggling with mental illness. When not advocating for technology and growing capacity in mental health treatment, Aiden takes it easy paddling dragon boat, running, and fencing with a sword, not fence posts. So go ahead, Aiden.
That one always needs clarification. Like, oh,
just making sure.
You like fencing, so you can like come to my yard and build me a fence. I'm like, no, you know, white suit, mask thing, pointy sword. Yeah. It's like the ultimate like stress reliever. Going at somebody with a sword. I don't know. Maybe that's not something good to promote. Anyway, it's a pleasure to be here today. I don't get to talk about eating disorders very much, although I get to talk about it twice this month. And it's something very important to me as somebody who's been affected by it directly. I think it's great that Paul earlier pointed out, you know, a lot of myths, because definitely I don't fit a lot of... I fit one of the like... stereotypes, but I definitely don't fit many of them, being I identify as a cis male, which means I identify as being straight. And like Paul said, you know, a lot of LGBT community is often believed to be affected by eating disorders on the area of in the gender of men and boys. And so, clearly not true. Also, when I first started to be affected by my eating disorder, which was anorexia, I definitely was not a star athlete. I did compete in sports, probably because my coach felt too bad to cut me because I was just too determined in sports. But I made really good relationships in cross country with the guy who came second last. So... And actually, there was one situation where I was in, I think it was regionals or something, because I guess everybody qualifies in cross country because nobody wants to do cross country. But there was actually one of the marshals went on his walkie-talkie and said, "Those runners you thought were lost, nope, they're just slow." So, not a star athlete and straight. But I do have one similarity that unfortunately is very hard to admit to. I am a survivor of sexual abuse. And... the reason why I believe today why it took me so long to get care was because my abuser was actually a parent. And after my parents divorced when I was around 6 years old, I was reliant on that parent. And so symptoms did not come up. Concern did not come up. And definitely hospitals, emergency rooms, doctor's offices, as you can imagine, when a parent is doing that to a child, those are places that are avoided. To the point that even sexual education at school, back then there were still permission slips that went home to advise parents that, oh, by the way, we're going to talk to your kids about sex. Well, guess what? Sexual abuse parents don't really send their kids to those sort of instructional information. It's great to see that schools maybe have learned that and they just sort of teach it now. Which is interesting that at 27, I'm definitely the young guy in the situation. But it's interesting to see how mental health has changed so much. And I say it's a pro and a con, because I say that I was on the cusp of the change, but I was never in the change, which was very difficult for me for treatment. I went through a lot of the situations that Paul explained. Definitely can relate to talking to my general practitioner about challenges that I was having, and definitely eventual concerns when I was probably 19 or 20. That he had with my weight and things like that, but not seeking treatment at a time, you know, being involved, had difficulty because I lived in Burnaby, which was technically outside of Vancouver Coastal Health. And when I finally came up on wait lists for things like St. Paul's eating disorders and things like that, it was held against me that I lived two blocks away from Boundary and so was not eligible for a Vancouver Coastal Health program of this particular type. All of these difficulties really gave me a very jaded opinion on healthcare, and I really felt, you know, in my early 20s that nobody wants to help me. And so I started to create thinking within myself that if nobody wants to help me, then maybe I am just making all this up. Maybe there is nothing wrong with me. And so that, as you can imagine, created a very vicious cycle. And my situation, of course, worsened. Employment was hard to hold down. From very early symptoms of when I was around 16, 17, I worked for Staples because I'm a dork.
Me too.
Yeah. Guys in red. Awesome. In computers, so I guess I've been in technology all the time. I actually distinctly remember I was helping sell a printer to a client, and at first I was kind of dizzy, and then I was sweating a lot, and then my vision became kind of blurry, and then my two customers kind of looked at me kind of funny, because I'm sure I was wavering at this point, and before you knew it, I passed out in the middle of the printer aisle in Staples. And at the time, I was also self-harming, because I did not know how to cope with numerous symptoms, eating disorder being one of them, which also proved very difficult for my care team, because I had psychologists saying, well, I can't give you like six diagnoses in the DSM. It's like, but you qualify for all of them. So at the time, you know, dealing with anxiety, dealing with depression, dealing with an eating disorder, dealing with self-harm to cope with it, dealing with suicidal ideology, all, of course, symptoms that happen when PTSD ultimately goes undiagnosed for almost 10 years and going through sexual abuse that had happened for that many years, which I later found out that we have this awesome diagnosis called complex PTSD, which they put all those things together into one fancy little package, but future revelations. So anyway, here I was, Staples, passed out, paramedics came. Luckily, they were great paramedics. First thing they did was made sure my supervisors stayed at a distance, and they asked some very direct questions, and they said, you know, are you self-harming? It's like, yeah. And when's the last time you ate? You know, 3 days ago. To the point that they were trying to take my, like, blood sugar, and they, like, poked me multiple times. Like, you're not bleeding very well. And I'm like, is that, do people often not bleed very well? They're like, no. So here I was, and it was a deep hole, and it was a difficult hole, and I didn't know where to go. And meanwhile, the health world at that time still echoing, you know, you're a guy, you can't have eating disorder. And I'm like, well, you also said that I'm a guy and I can't be raped too. And well, that happened. So how does it change? And how did those around me help change that? And ultimately, how did I finally get care from the medical system? And I think one important thing to point out, and then I like to point out, is this conversation, mental illness, is a gender-neutral illness. And Paul's talked about it today recently, and, you know, we always run into it as a blogger and somebody who does a lot in online and social media. There's always this very difficult, very sensitive topic. Anytime that we bring up, it's like us versus them, or guys versus girls, or lack of care here versus lack of care there. And I think it's really strong that we address that that isn't our purpose for this conversation. I think that the purpose of this conversation is to identify that mental illness affects both of our genders. That, you know, we're talking specifically about mental illness on eating disorders today, but we know on the spectrum of mental illness that men do struggle to come forward and seek assistance in a lot of areas. And we know that for a fact, and to put magnitude to that, is over 3,700 people in our country die by suicide each year. A vast majority of those are male. And we know that that correlates directly to lack of access to services, or accessing services too late, or just the stigma of that these illnesses have on particular gender, that is told from a very early age that we don't talk about emotions, we don't have feelings, and we're supposed to be strong and athletic in our society. So I actually, went through a lot of high school, went through earlier years of school, and sports, although I was terrible at them, were an asset to keeping me alive, because I found out that extracurricular activities meant you didn't have to go home at the end of the day, which was fantastic. And so as an early adult, I said, well, what's a sport that I can do? And I found Dragon Boat. I had friends that were in Dragon Boat, and I said, well, that's just far too unique of a sport to not try. Because how many people in Vancouver get an opportunity twice a week to get out on the ocean and in a boat with 22 or, well, I guess minus me, 21 other people, including a steers person and a caller, and get to paddle? And it was incredible. And now that I do more public health professionally, you know, we know the research behind, you know, rhythmic motion of paddling, and we see this very beneficial in a lot of very symptom similar cases. And so Dragon Boat was huge, not just because of the athleticism, but because of the community. And a big part of my recovery, because unfortunately, like I said, I was on that cusp, you know, our system wasn't directly treating males as well as we're doing today, and we definitely have room to improve, but we're doing a lot better than we were when I was those age, in that age group. And so that community, that support for wellness, for health. And so I started to think about that. I started to think about my thoughts behind my illness. And for me, the longest time struggling with anorexia, unlike a lot of people, you know, we talk about, you know, seeking that perfection or seeking to meet societal standards. For me, I wanted to disappear. And that was directly correlated because of the abuse. And I saw eating disorder. I saw limiting the amount of food that I took. You know, how small can I be? How invisible can I be? Because if they can't see me, they can't hurt me. And that shifted when I started to think, well, how can I make a difference? What do I need to do to make a difference? And we know very well in advocacy that the first step to making a difference and the first step to being an advocate in this community is we need to take care of ourselves. And so when it came to eating disorder, I said, well, how can I take the numbers out of it? And fitness was my way of taking the numbers out of it. I wanted to be fit. I didn't want to be a particular weight. I didn't want to be a particular size. I just wanted to be fit. And so that started me on a healthy routine. And so I started doing things like actually baby steps. I have the, I guess, privilege of having friends in multiple countries around the world, particularly in Asia. And I remember very early on when I started this new mindset, I would go on Skype really late at night, my time, normal time, their time. And I would say, I want to eat a meal with you, but there's some ground rules. You can't ask me how the food tastes. You can't bring up the food at all. Do not talk to me about the food. But you eat something, I'll eat something, we'll chat, it'll be good. KK? And that was the start of recovery for me, was going to peers and getting that understanding and starting to converse with them about the language that I needed from them at the time on how to talk to me as I went through this recovery. So I went from that to, you know, having face-to-face meals. You know, I was now sort of mid-20s. I had a job. I was stable, so I could afford to go out and eat in restaurants more often. And what 25-year-old is going to eat cooked dinners at home when I can, like, go to White Spot? So meals and that community and that coming together, and again, it was peer support. It was peer support from the beginning. It was peer support sort of all the way through, you know, because I was eating again, I was more susceptible or like to want to go and get treatment. I did have some time with male survivors here in Vancouver and got some treatment around sexual abuse. I actually went to GP appointments, rare for guys in general to actually go to their doctor, and started monitoring, again, making those agreements that with my doctor, it's like, do not tell me what weight I am. Are you concerned or are you less concerned? You're less concerned? Great, we're making progress. Don't tell me numbers. Was very, very important because being a very analytical person and to the point that I would go and have meetings with dietitians and they're like, there's nothing we can do for him. He has a very strong understanding of nutrition and diet and he knows exactly what he's doing in that case. And with that, I think it's important to make a distinction as some of the colleagues, previous speakers made. Was, and this comes up for me a lot when people say, well, eating disorder sounds like something that you really was your choice. And I said that that's false. And they're like, well, how do you know? Because people make choices to go on diets. There are, you know, people, there's a degree on that spectrum where we look and we say, you know, hey, I want to lose 5 pounds and things like that. For me, when I was struggling with anorexia, it was something subconsciously in my mind that told me, it forced me. It was beyond my control. I could not resist. When I saw food, I wanted to my internal functioning resisted that, to eat it. Even if I was starving, even if I was passing out at work, I couldn't do it. And that's the difference between, you know, early ARI spectrum, where we need to see those warning signs of concerns, to the disorder itself. So here I am, you know, obviously well into recovery, and I want to leave us with that last note of not just for eating disorders, but something I think that we lack in a discussion in mental illness, and that's the recovery phase. I celebrate the fact that if I were to go to talk to any clinician, some I'm sure in this room right now, I would not meet the DSM standards for anorexia. And that was a really big accomplishment for me. And I think it's something that we miss a lot with patients